Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the succession in Saudi Arabia following the death of King Abdullah and the pilgrimage of world leaders, including President Obama, who is cutting short his visit to India, to the oil-rich family kingdom to pay their respects to the new King Salman at a time when Saudi foreign policy seems to be collapsing all around the kingdom. Lina Khatib, the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, joins us to discuss the likely tenure of the new king, who is reported to have Alzheimer's, and the role of the Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, who recently took over the Syria portfolio from the former defense minister, Prince Bandar bin Sultan. Then we'll examine the kingdom and its future further with Robert Lacey, a British historian and best-selling author, whose latest book is Inside the Kingdom: Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. He joins us to discuss the validity of the constant refrain in the media that the late King Abdullah was a reformer and that his successor will carry on his policies. We'll also look into the Saudi strategy of flooding the global market to lower the price of oil, which is hurting the frackers in the United States, not to mention Iran, Russia, and Venezuela. Then finally, we'll go to Athens, Greece, for an update on the results of Sunday's critical elections, expected to bring the new leftist Syriza party to power, which will shake up the Eurozone, since Syriza's leader, Alex Tsipras, has vowed, quote, a return of social dignity and social justice that is expected to involve a renegotiation of Greece's debt arrangements and the austerity measures imposed on the Greek people after a series of bailouts by the EU and the ECB. John Brady Kiesling, a former political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Athens, who now lives in Athens and is the author of the new book, Greek Urban Warriors, Resistance and Terrorism, 1967 to 2014, joins us to discuss the political earthquake underway in Greece and its likely fallout. And joining us now is Lina Khatib, who is the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. Previously, she was the co-founding head of the Program on Arab Reform and Democracy at Stanford University's Center on Democracy, Development and the Rule of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lina Khatib.
Hello.
And Lina, what's your understanding of the succession, particularly in terms of the new generation that represented by Mohammed bin Nayef, who's the deputy crown prince? My understanding was that Abdullah wanted his son Metheb in that position. So what forces worked behind the scenes in that family dynasty to bring about this representative of a new generation?
Well, first of all, we should explain that succession in Saudi Arabia, since the founding of the kingdom, has gone from one brother to another, as opposed to from one person to their son. And the late king passed on the rule of the kingdom to his half-brother, Salman. And we also have a crown prince who is called Prince Mukrin, who is another half-brother of the late king. But after that, there are no half-brothers or full-brothers left who are alive. Most of these people are in their 80s. And therefore, there was an open question about succession, because it's relatively simple to pass rule from one brother to another. But what about the younger generation? And that's why there was competition between people who wanted basically their own sons to take over as the next king of Saudi Arabia. And in this, Mohammed bin Nayef was much more popular than any of the other princes around him. And he also had support from his relative on his mother's side. He had an international profile, which also helped, had good relations with the United States, for instance. Prince Metheb, who was he is the son of the late King Abdullah, was not such a high-profile person and did not manage to get support from the tribes in Saudi Arabia to the same extent as Mohammed bin Nayef. So now we have a situation whereby Prince Salman has become king. Mukarram will be his crown prince, but the real mover and shaker in Saudi Arabia today is actually Mohammed bin Nayef, the deputy crown prince.
And his other post, which is arguably more important, is the general secretary of the royal court. And he's replacing a kind of éminence gris, a kind of Cardinal Richelieu type figure, Khalid al-Tawajri, who apparently has been very influential in Saudi foreign policy of late in terms of financing the counter-revolution in Egypt and sending troops into Bahrain and early financing of the Islamic State in Syria. All of which happened under, in conjunction, I believe, with Prince Bandar bin Sultan. So, is that where the real shakeup is in terms of foreign policy and getting and replacing this kind of éminence gris?
Basically, Mohammed bin Nayef has tried to reverse some of the policies that had been directed by Prince Bandar bin Sultan. Prince Bandar bin Sultan was the person handling intelligence in Saudi Arabia, and he took a very hardline method towards the Syrian conflict, for instance, by supporting all kinds of jihadist groups in Syria, thinking that this would be the best way to get rid of the Bashar al-Assad regime. But this caused problems for the kingdom because there are thousands of Saudi nationals who are fighting in Syria today, mainly with groups like the Islamic State. And therefore, the kingdom became very concerned about domestic repercussions were these fighters to come back to the kingdom. And that's why Mohammed bin Nayef and his camp took over from Bandar, the Syria file, under the direction of the late king, because they realized that this track is not going to be very successful. So for a while, there was a bit of a clash between the Bandar camp and the bin Nayef camp. And the bin Nayef camp is more interested in pragmatism and counter-radicalization. And this is largely because Mohammed bin Nayef used to be the person who headed Saudi Arabia's terrorist rehabilitation programs and de-radicalization programs. And he is also the Minister of Interior. So in a way, Saudi Arabia has realized that the domestic situation and its foreign policy are very much connected. But right now, of course, because of Tawajri's high profile, there is a degree of competition that Mohammed bin Nayef is already facing in his new position as Deputy Crown Prince, because the funding going from different Saudi princes to jihadist groups in Syria has not actually stopped. And this will make it very difficult for Mohammed bin Nayef to, you know, be able to be bolder in his next foreign policy move.
And again, I'm speaking with Lina Hatib, who is the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. And previously, she was the co-founding head of the program on Arab reform and democracy at Stanford University's Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law. So what do you make of the fact that Egypt's president, Sisi, did not show up for the funeral, whereas the head of Turkey and Pakistan did? So is there any significance to that?
This is actually very, very significant because Saudi Arabia has been the force that has put Sisi in power in Egypt. Prior to Sisi taking over, the Egyptian state was under the control of the Muslim Brotherhood, and Saudi Arabia regards the Muslim Brotherhood as its key political challenger in the region. And that's why Saudi Arabia funded and supported the military popular-backed coup last year that removed President Morsi from power and installed in his place, sorry, it wasn't last year, it was 2013, and installed in his place the current president, Sisi. And so for Sisi not to go to the funeral, I think speaks volumes about his stance not towards the current king, but towards Mohammed bin Nayef, who is the person, as I said, who is now actually calling the shots in Saudi Arabia. And I think this is because bin Nayef might be seen as wanting to reverse some of the directives that had been directed by people like Tuwaijiri before, which actually were very supportive for someone like Sisi. So I think there might be an interesting twist in Saudi-Egyptian relations further down the line. But this does not mean a reversal. I think it's just simply Sisi trying to assert himself as his own man in this equation.
So, Lina Hatib, I mentioned in the opening that Saudi foreign policy seems to be collapsing all around them, and arguably in that neighbourhood you've always had enemies, but Saudis have got Islamic State to their north, Syria roiling, Jordan under intense pressure from the refugee crisis. And then to the south, you've had this political earthquake that coincided with the King Abdullah's death, and that is the Houthi taking over effectively, and Saudi's proxy there collapsing. There's something weird going on with the former Yemeni strongman, Ali Abdullah Asala, who apparently has been working the back channels with the Houthi. And did the Saudis' obsession with the Muslim Brotherhood screw things up for them in Yemen?
Actually, Yemen is more complicated than it appears. Although Saudi Arabia is publicly condemning the Houthi takeover, as you hinted, Ali Abdullah Saleh is Saudi Arabia's man. And Saudi Arabia is keeping the channels of communication open with the Houthis. And in fact, Saudi Arabia is benefiting from the Houthi takeover in Yemen because it can use it as an excuse to eventually call for or support the separation of northern Yemen from southern Yemen. And if southern Yemen becomes independent, then Saudi Arabia will have a whole Yemeni state that is a very close client to the kingdom. And that would allow it access to Bab al-Mandeb and access to the sea, the ocean, without needing to resort to the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf, depending if you talk to the Arabs or the Iranians about the name. So basically, in doing so, Saudi Arabia can free itself from Iranian pressure in the region. And that's why right now I wouldn't call the Yemeni situation as being a disaster for Saudi Arabia, because there is a bit of interest going on. Saudi Arabia is actually being quite pragmatic in Yemen, and it's more or less willing to accept the Houthis next door, knowing that they're Iranian allies. Having them in place is better than having the Muslim Brotherhood in place, I guess. And so the situation in Yemen means that eventually Saudi Arabia will be able to consolidate power all over the Gulf and bring pro-Muslim Brotherhood forces like Qatar back in line so that they won't overstep Saudi interests. And this is all part of a campaign that had started in Saudi Arabia early last year. And it's all driven by Saudi's fears about the Muslim Brotherhood rising in power in the region. And so far, Saudi Arabia has actually succeeded in this process.
But the Saudi obsession with the Muslim Brotherhood, I imagine, is fairly simple, which is that they're afraid of that's an example of political Islam, where Islam and democracy or representative government are compatible. And they have a reactionary, almost medieval kingdom that they preside over with little to no representation. So is that at the heart of their objection to the Muslim Brotherhood?
The objection to the Muslim Brotherhood is simply about the Brotherhood being the most likely political actor to challenge Saudi Arabia in terms of power and influence. And that's because it's a political group supported by an Islamic ideology. So in this sense, it's similar to what Saudi Arabia represents. And it's a group with wide support all over the Middle East. And it's a group that's very, very organized and works underground and works from the bottom up. And so if this group were to reach power, then it is likely to form a key political challenge for Saudi Arabia. And also, the Muslim Brotherhood is a key client of Qatar, which is Saudi Arabia's main rival in the Gulf. And so for all these reasons, Saudi Arabia fears that the Muslim Brotherhood can, in a way, appropriate its idea of Islamic rule and therefore take over from the kingdom in being the leading political force in the Middle East. And that's why it has been seeking for a very long time to try to weaken this movement all over the region.
But my understanding is that the Saudi royal family, that it's basically a family-run country, their legitimacy and the reason they have their arrangement with the Wahhabis is that they are the custodians of the holy shrines of Mecca and Medina, and that the Iranians have been challenging that notion, and of late, the Islamic State is challenging that notion by talking about its own caliphate. So given the pressure, particularly from the Islamic State, that would suggest to me, Alina Hatib, that the Saudis will be sort of forced to be even more reactionary and austere and fundamentalist because they're being challenged on their right flank, if you will.
And this is their own doing, because the Sharia law followed by the Islamic State is the same one followed by Saudi Arabia. The Islamic State follows Wahhabism as well and takes a very hard line. I mean, Wahhabism is already hard line, but the Islamic State takes it to a whole new level of extremism. And the Islamic State ideology is the product of many Wahhabi preachers supported by Saudi Arabia, who were sent globally, not just in the Middle East, to preach Wahhabi ideology and recruit supporters. And these people are now, instead of migrating to Saudi Arabia, they're migrating to Syria and Iraq to join the Islamic State. And so now Saudi Arabia sees that its own propagation of ideology, which it had done in order to gain loyals all over the world, has backfired, and instead it has created this other monster that is beginning to form not just an ideological threat to Saudi Arabia, but also a security threat. We saw earlier this month, for instance, an attack in the north of Saudi Arabia by forces affiliated with ISIS. And that's why now bin Nayef in particular is trying to lead a bit of a rethink in Saudi Arabia about what to do about the situation. But the problem is, in Saudi Arabia, the Council of Ulama, which is the highest religious authority in the country, remains very influential and very conservative and very resistant to any form of reform. And now the kingdom basically faces a conundrum, and it is at a loss as to what to do about it.
Well, just in closing, Alina Hatib, since you're based in Beirut, my sense is that things could get, and of course, there's been a history of turmoil in Lebanon, but things seem to be getting a little tense now following the Israeli drone strike on the Golan Heights that killed an Iranian Revolutionary Guard general and also the son of Mughniyeh, the infamous Hezbollah military leader responsible for a number of high-profile terrorist attacks. It would seem that it's inevitable that some kind of retaliation will come from Hezbollah. And a lot in the Israeli press, of course, there are suggestions that Netanyahu is doing this because he wants a distraction prior to these upcoming elections, since arguably there's no such thing as Israeli foreign policy, but it's all about domestic politics. And that also explains Netanyahu's trip to speak to the Congress ahead of the elections, which, of course, is a slap in the face to the President of the United States. So do you think your neighborhood is going to be plunged into some kind of war or military action?
No, I don't think so. In fact, there is something in common between Hezbollah and Israel, which is that each uses the other for scaremongering and to bring its supporters back in line. So what I'm saying is the attack by Israel against Hezbollah and Iran fighters that we saw in the Golan Heights has been used both by Israel and Hezbollah to rally people around them and to support the legitimacy of their leaders. And so Hezbollah uses it to say to people, see, we told you Israel is a threat and you should support us because we are the only people who will defend you. And Netanyahu is doing the same thing. He wants to scare the Israeli public so that they would support him in the next election by saying, see, now Hezbollah is going to retaliate. The reality is, Hezbollah is weakened as a result of its involvement in the Syrian conflict. It's fighting alongside the Syrian regime. It's also fighting in Iraq against ISIS. And, of course, it has a presence in Lebanon. It cannot afford to have three military fronts. It's not in its interest. And that's something that Israel knows very well. Israel knows that if it attacks Hezbollah now, Hezbollah will not be able to retaliate, at least not in a significant way. And so here we have the use of military force for political gains, which I think has played right into the hands of Israel and Hezbollah in this particular instance.
Well, Alina Hatiba, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alina Hatib, who is the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. Previously, she was the co-founding head of the program on Arab reform and democracy at Stanford University's Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining further the kingdom and its future, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and its future. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from the UK is Robert Lacey, who's a British historian and the author of numerous international bestsellers, among them Majesty, his biography of Queen Elizabeth II, The Kingdom, A Study of Saudi Arabia, Ford, The Men and the Machine, and Great Tales from English History. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Lacey.
Thank you, Ian.
And what's your understanding of the politics behind this succession in Saudi Arabia, given that apparently the victim, if you will, or the person that's been downgraded in this is Khalid al-Tawajri, who's a kind of éminence gris, and his position, Secretary of the Royal Court, has now been taken over by the Deputy Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Nayef. And apparently this has a lot to do with a sense that Saudi foreign policy of late has blown up in the kingdom's face.
Well, you've raised a lot there, Ian, but that's always how things are about Saudi Arabia. Yes, King Abdullah died. Sorry, we're getting interference on the line, is that right?
No, it sounds okay to me.
Okay, sorry. King Abdullah, the long-serving King of Saudi Arabia, died last Friday, and he has been succeeded by his half-brother, who's now King Salman, and King Salman named as his crown prince another half brother,
Mukrin.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm going to play back at this end, which is rather distracting, but I'll try and keep going in. The thing to remember about one of the things to remember about the Saudi succession is that it's a horizontal succession. Until now, the sons of Abdulaziz, the great creator of the kingdom who died in 1953, have succeeded each other, moving sideways, as it were. And the significance of these latest changes are that Mughran, now named as Crown Prince and thus future king, is in fact the last of his sons, the last of the brothers. And so the question was, who will come next? Who will be the standard bearer from the next generation? And this has been decided rather, to everyone's surprise, very rapidly by the new King Salman, who has named the Interior Minister, Mohammed bin Naif, head of security, very powerful, though rather quiet and unknown, mysterious man, to be the number three. And it must be presumed, therefore, that he will be taking over in the future. All these changes mean that the gentleman you mentioned, Khalid al-Tuwaijiri, who was the gatekeeper to the late King Abdullah, has been thrown out on his ear, basically, as King Abdullah declined in his later years, so that in the last year, really, he could only attend to business for an hour or so every day. He was over 90 years old. He was operating on one lung and with a terribly bad back and in constant pain. It was Tuwaijiri who made these decisions to which you're referring about foreign policy, or at least that's how it seemed to people. So the question now is, with Tuwaijiri removed, with Abdullah removed, will Salman and Mughran as well push Saudi Arabia in a new direction?
And what is your understanding, though, of the health of the new king, Salman, whose only public statement seemed quite garbled and not very confident, and he's reported to have Alzheimer's?
You're quite right, Ian. There are many rumours that he suffers from Alzheimer's or some sort of dementia. Last time I saw him, he seemed perfectly bright. I was talking the other day to Frank Gardner, the BBC security correspondent, who saw him only a few months ago, who said that he's clearly not the man he used to be. He's an immensely impressive character. He was governor of Riyadh for 40 years. He was, of all the 35 sons of Abdulaziz, the one whom people said most resembled his father, and commanded that sort of stature, as he still commands it, among the tribes and among the traditionally religious folk. But he now walks with a stick. Frank Gardner said to me, and I only really go on first-hand evidence about this sort of thing, that he saw no evidence of dementia. But other people say that Salman doesn't seem able to concentrate for very long and wanders off. And so, you know, someone like Mughran, his crown prince, thus becomes more important.
So, Robert, I have some questions about the strategy behind the lowering of the price of oil and flooding the market. Most analysis suggests that somehow this is being done in concert with the United States. And, you know, when the U.S. Leaders, Secretary of State, National Security Advisors, Joint Chiefs, when they ever meet with the Saudis, apparently it's all very secret and they don't even take notes. So it's very difficult to know exactly what goes on in these meetings. But there's an assumption that the fact that the low price of oil is hurting people in America is not happy with Russia, Iran, and Venezuela is some sort of concerted strategy with the Saudis. My sense is that perhaps there's something else going on here, and that is maybe the Saudis recognize that global warming is real and that they've got something like 20 years to pump as much as they can. And they've already made some statements recently that allude to the idea that this low price could go on for some time. One senior official said, we're getting rid of the marginal producers, which I interpret as the fracking people. Another official just a couple of days ago said that this will go on for a while and that they can handle the low prices. So are they trying to basically drive everybody out of business?
To some degree, although what you said at the beginning was absolutely correct. The Saudis don't make a move when it comes to oil. or when it comes to defense matters without consulting America, or when it comes to financial matters. The real is absolutely anchored to the dollar, and the real's reserves are almost entirely invested in dollars, and in the difficult years of a few years ago, it was Saudi investments, solid Saudi investments that helped keep the dollar strong. When we turn to oil, an important point to notice is that Saudi Arabian oil policy is kept strictly out of the hands of the royal family, although, of course, everything's agreed with the king. The oil minister is never a royal. He's a technocrat. So the current minister, Ali Al-Niami, has been there for many decades. And yes, you're right. The Saudis take the long-term view. To some degree, what they're doing at the moment does involve knocking some of the frackers out of the market. The thing to note about Saudi oil reserves is that they are probably the largest in the world. We're not sure whether they or the Russians have more. But they are certainly the least expensive to extract in the world. Saudi oil is close to the surface, uncomplicated to bring up. It may cost $5, $6, $7, $8, $9, $10 a barrel at the most to extract one barrel of Saudi oil. And that, of course, compares to $60, $70, $80 a barrel for some fracked oil. Having said that, the Saudis are very happy in many ways with the fracking revolution, because from their point of view, it has helped postpone the day to which you just referred, Ian, when other energy sources come on stream. They were really rather worried as American dependence on its own oil diminished, because the thing about fracking from the Saudis' point of view, yes, fracked American oil competes with them, but also fracked American oil keeps America and North America, Canada and South America and the whole world really hooked on old-fashioned petroleum. And that's very nice from the Saudi point of view. So their policy at the moment is dealing with an unexpected situation. Everybody thought the price of oil would stay around 100. It's sunk, as you know, to 50, and may well be at that for some time. I'd say one last thing about Saudi policy in this respect. It goes back very much to the 1980s and 90s, when a similar situation occurred. The price of oil fell, and in those days, the Saudis worked very hard and rather unselfishly, actually, to be what they called the swing producer, and were willing to cut production in order to try and maintain the price. And this was to help their fellow members of OPEC. They got no response to that at all from their fellow OPEC members, who went on gaily producing oil as much as they could to sell. And so this time round, the Saudis are basically saying to OPEC, well, screw you. We are going to maintain our position in the market. And of course, just perhaps one last thing, Ian, since all this has happened, there's been the Arab Spring, 2011. The Saudi response to that was to dramatically increase spending on social services, government employment, enormous, well, you could call them bribes to the population to stay loyal. And that means that the Saudis do need probably $70 or $80 for every barrel of oil in order to pay for these enormous social programs. They can afford it for a few more years as things stand because they have massive financial reserves. They're a very conservative bunch. The moment they started making money a few years ago, they used it to pay off debt. So they're in a very strong position as compared to most other oil producers.
And Robert Lacey, the fact that we hear this constant refrain in the media that the late King Abdullah was a reformer and that his successor will carry on his policies. A lot of people, of course, in the UK, there's been a lot of objections to Buckingham Palace lowering its flag to the half mast, etc. And a lot of people are saying, you know, what are you talking about, reformers? I mean, this is a medieval kingdom. They behead people. Women have no female rights, etc. So, and the then when you hear that, you also hear, well, you know, the king really tried to do the best he could, but he's up against this incredibly conservative religious establishment. My understanding is that that's the whole compact that the royal family has, that we get to control everything, and you guys, you know, keep everybody in line with all these religious strictures. So give me a picture of this religious establishment. Are they that omnipotent?
They're very, very powerful. There are 50,000 preachers in Saudi Arabia. Of course, ultimately, they're all on the government payroll, but they are of the fundamentalist, so-called Wahhabi persuasion, Salafis, jihadists, if you like. Many of them in their hearts rejoice at what they see ISIS and ISIL doing. They are very, very deeply anti-Western. And you're quite right. The House of Saud has made a sort of compact with the devil. Of course, they would be deeply offended to hear that sort of thing said. But it's a sort of Frankenstein that the House of Saud exploited these fundamentalist warriors in order to create the kingdom. In the early years of the last century, the present king's father, Abdulaziz, his warriors, his so-called Ikhwan brethren, were little different in character from ISIS and ISIL today. If they found infidels, they slaughtered them, and they included Shiites in that. Having used them to create the kingdom, the House of Saud said, thanks very much, we're going to become a modern Western state now. And since that time, there has been conflict between the religious traditionalists and the attempts by the House of Saud to modernize. In that context, Abdullah has to be written down as a modernizer, a reformer. I was in the kingdom a few years ago when he announced, to everyone's surprise, that he was going to place 30 women on the National Consultative Council, which passes for parliament in Saudi Arabia, 30 out of 150 members. The decision was greeted with outrage. You actually saw priests demonstrating against this. They were actually calling for democracy because they felt quite rightly, I think, that if there were a vote in Saudi Arabia among the men of Saudi Arabia tomorrow, they would vote against all these attempts by Abdullah to give rights to women. All the Saudi women I knew regarded Abdullah as a hero. He was their Elvis. They felt that he had done his, they understood the situation there. You see, the thing you have to remember, Ian, is that no, Saudi Arabia may not seem very modern and reformed by Western standards, although let's not forget there's capital punishment in Texas, and quite a few people in various states in America suffer from capital punishment. It's in private, maybe, different from in the street, but you know, I think there's a lot of double standards when it comes to criticizing Saudi Arabia, but the countries you have to compare Saudi Arabia to are not us, the so-called sophisticated Western democracies. You have to compare what's going on in Saudi Arabia today with what's happening in Iraq or Syria. And I can tell you that the average Saudi and many other people in the Middle East, many Arabs, would much rather live in the peace and security of Saudi Arabia. Their democratic rights are limited. But look what democracy produced in Egypt or Palestine or anywhere. This is all relative. And as I say, in that relative context, Abdullah struggled to do his best. The last time I met King Abdullah, he was shaking hands with Jewish rabbis. Now, that was in Madrid at a conference he organized to try and encourage religious toleration. He could never, you might say this is extraordinary, but the King of Saudi Arabia himself could not arrange such a conference in Saudi Arabia. It would have been a revolution. He had to go abroad to do this, and his Institute for Religious Toleration, which he hoped to bring back to Saudi Arabia, was forbidden by the church, and it now resides in Vienna. So, absolute tyrant though he was, there were limits when it came to Islam and religion.
Well, Robert Lacey, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian, very much. And I'm sorry about the bad line. I look forward to
No problem. And thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Lacey, a British historian and the author of numerous international bestsellers, among them Majesty, his biography of Queen Elizabeth II, The Kingdom, A Study of Saudi Arabia, Ford, The Men and the Machine, and Great Tales from English History. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. We're going to take a brief station break and be back and go to Athens for an update on the critical elections underway. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Athens, Greece, is John Brady Kiesling, a former political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Athens. He was the first of three U.S. Foreign Service officers to resign in protest of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. He served in Israel, Morocco, Greece, Washington, and Armenia, returning to Athens as chief of the political section of the U.S. Embassy. Fluent in Greek, he now lives in Athens, where he writes and lectures. He wrote a monthly column called Diplomat in the Ruins and the Athens News, and his books include Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower, and his latest book just out is Greek Urban Warriors, Resistance and Terrorism, 1967 to 2014. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Brady Kiesling.
Thanks for having me.
And what are the latest results now from the elections today in Greece? It's what, about 8 or 9 in the evening?
That's right. It's 9:45, and the Ministry of Interior has just released their estimate that Syriza, the coalition of the radical left, is going to end up with 149 to 151 seats. That is either a marginal majority or falling just short. New Democracy, the center-right governing party, dropped a couple of percentage points. The other parties have been creamed pretty badly, except for the communists. Golden Dawn, the fascist party, has done well. There's a new party, Potami, which is holding up okay. But the big story is that Syriza, you know, a fairly seriously leftist party, is going to take power for the first time in Greece.
And does it need a coalition?
It looks like it's going to need one additional party. In practical terms, it can govern on its own with 150 seats, but for certain purposes, it's probably going to go with a party calling itself Independent Greeks, run by a sort of crazed nationalist called Kamenos, who desperately wants a job in the government and will be pretty cooperative with them.
And I take it that the communists, who have about 20% of the vote, don't they? I mean, would they be more troublesome, right, than this more compliant party, Independent Greeks?
Well, the old line Communist Party of Greece, the sort of the Moscow communists, they've done reasonably well, about 5.5%, but they've always made clear they're an opposition party and they're not going to change. So they're pretty irrelevant. We'll have Syriza dominating the government with probably 13 to 15 members of parliament from Independent Greeks, essentially looking out for their own interests and trying to make money.
And the Golden Dawn, the fascist party, what percentage did they get?
It looks like about 6%, a little higher. The problem is they're probably going to be the third largest party, which is psychologically, it's a bad sign for the country, because this is a group that has no redeeming features. Its leadership is in jail. Its ideology is frankly fascist, even, you know, Nazi symbols, a lot of sort of the worst kind of heavy metal stuff, and a strong connection to extortion rackets and the like. So the fact that 6% plus of the population voted for them is a depressing reminder of human nature.
Now, are Golden Dawn being funded by Putin? Apparently, Putin is funding the fascist parties in the right-wing Le Pen's party in France and fascist parties in Hungary and other countries. Any evidence of that?
No one's been able to prove it. It's a story that goes round. It's possible. But let's keep an open mind.
Sure. Again, I'm speaking with John Brady Keesling, who's a former political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Athens. He was the first of three U.S. Foreign Service officers to resign in protest of the 2003 invasion of Iraq, and he served in Israel, Morocco, Greece, Washington, and Armenia, returning to Athens as chief of the political section of the U.S. Embassy. He's fluent in Greek and now lives in Athens, and his latest book is just out, is Greek Urban Warriors, Resistance and Terrorism, 1967 to 2014. So your book is a reminder that there's been some ugly political periods in Greece's recent history.
This is true. And my book starts with the Greek junta and the armed resistance to that, which is a useful reminder that not everyone who plants a bomb is a bad person. In fact, in the current political life of Greece, there are a number of people who planted bombs against the dictatorship. That said, after the restoration of democracy, violence was a completely counterproductive dead end. What we see currently in Greece has very little to do with that old, essentially Maoist violence. We have anarchist groups that still blow up ATMs and rob banks, but they're politically irrelevant, and the Syriza's victory, I think, will shut them up for the next several months.
So let's look into Syriza's likely political platform, and they've made it pretty clear where they stand with the leader of Syriza, Alex Tsipras, vowing, quote, a return of social dignity and social justice. And most people seem to think that that means renegotiating Greece's debt arrangements with the EU and the ECB and reversing these austerity measures imposed on the Greek people after a series of bailouts.
Yes, he is going to try that. And the European Union is going to tell him, okay, this is all possible within the context of reforms that make sense. And so far, Syriza has not talked about any reforms that make sense. The Greek state is this huge, almost dead elephant lying on its side, eating and excreting and not producing anything useful but blocking the economy, making investment almost impossible. That elephant has to be either shot and buried or else revived. Syriza, I don't think, knows how to do it. It's going to try. It says it knows how, but it doesn't have enough levers of power of its own to goad the elephant to stand up. It doesn't have enough money to bribe the elephant to stand up. I mean, sorry, I'm mixing my metaphors. They are going to spend the next 3 months trying desperately to keep their checks from bouncing. And unfortunately, that's likely to become their full-time job over the next 2 years.
But Alex Tsipras has said that and the Greek people apparently have made it clear that they don't want to get out of the euro and go back to the drachma. Will that happen at the end of the day if things don't work out?
It's a real possibility. Not that very many people want it. A few do. There are serious economists who say that the euro has become a trap for Greece, and it's better to have a complete collapse, go through a mind-bendingly difficult period of poverty, but rebuild from scratch, you know, a new economy that can compete. That's easy for a theoretician to say, but ordinary people with ordinary lives do not want to see their bank accounts rendered worthless, do not want to see their pensions dropped from, say, $600 to $50, which is very likely what would happen if he went back to the drachma. So there's this conservatism in Greek society, which I think dominates Syriza's thinking as well.
Well, there's a certain amount of romanticism associated with Syriza's sudden rise, and the same with Podemos in Spain, in the West, and here amongst the American left, and the notion that finally, socialism gets a shot. But it sounds like this is more or less dead on arrival. If I'm to follow your elephant analogy. My understanding is that the Greeks don't pay taxes. There's so many Greeks have ghost jobs. The rich don't pay taxes. So, what possibly could be done to sort of start from a place of honesty and realism?
That's the hope, that Tsipras can be this inspirational figure. Remember that a lot of Greeks do pay taxes. Those who are salary earners, those who are working for the state, have no choice but to pay taxes. And they are deeply embittered by the fact that small businessmen don't pay taxes. Professionals conceal most of their income. That said, the state tax collecting mechanism is one of these horrible dysfunctional bureaucracies which is not doing its job, needs to be radically reformed. But Syriza does not believe that state employees should be fired unless they're convicted of a felony, which is a very slow process here, especially since the court system is another disaster. So there will be this inspirational moment. There are people dancing in the street, and they will go out and say, okay, we are all going to change. We are going to pay our taxes, sort of. Will it be enough? I'm skeptical. I'm afraid that, though I would like Tsipras to succeed, I think there are just too many problems in the way. His party is possessed of a philosophy of governance which is highly statist, highly protectionist of the rights of state employees, at a time when, you know, unfortunately, you need to use a cattle prod to get people to work effectively, and there is no cattle prod in his hands.
So what is the private sector, and what does Greece produce and sell?
First of all, Greece has a huge tourism industry, which, with reasonable regulation, does quite well. Second, it's got this class of ship owners who are not completely parasitic. I mean, they don't pay the taxes they could pay and should pay, but they do bring something to the country, and Tsipras has to handle them very carefully to get them to increase their contribution rather than simply flee to London, which is what they usually do when you tax them. So that's a difficult challenge. There's a lot of agriculture which could be made more effective. There's light industry, which now is not competitive in the world, but could be a bit more. Greece has a good location for transit infrastructure. The Chinese are investing heavily in it. Under the right circumstances, you could build up that logistical element. Greece can support itself with dignity, not as a rich country, but as an okay country, if you get everything exactly right.
And that's the big if, right? That there's internal divisions within the parties and not a sense of, well, at least at this point, not a sense of clarity. But it seems like this leader is fairly inspirational, isn't he, Alex Tsipras?
He's polarizing. For a lot of young people, he's very inspirational. For other people, he just drives them up the wall, and that's unfortunate. He has learned quite a bit. 2 years ago, if he had been elected in the 2012 elections, it would have been a disaster. Now it's not going to be a disaster. It's just a monumental challenge where, you know, with pitfalls everywhere, and statistically, the odds of falling into one of them are very good.
So just in closing then, is there, John Brady Keesling, is there any possibility of debt forgiveness, a jubilee?
There is a genuine prospect of renegotiating debt in the context of a Greek reform process that is seen as sincere, genuine, and effective. Unfortunately, the history of the past 50 years makes donors skeptical about Greek good intentions. Tsipras will have to achieve some really credible step first in order to open the doors to a serious discussion of debt forgiveness. Hard. Not impossible, but he will have to show political skills that he has never shown, and no Greek politician has shown since the older Karamanlis, you know, four decades ago.
I thought you were going to say since Pericles.
Well, let's not go back that far. The challenges are equivalent.
I thank you so much for joining us, John Brady Keesling.
Well, thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with John Brady Keesling, who's a former political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Athens. He was the first of three U.S. Foreign Service officers to resign in protest of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And he served in Israel, Morocco, Greece, Washington, and Armenia, returning to Athens as the chief of the political section at the U.S. Embassy. Fluent in Greek, he now lives in Athens, and his books include Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower, and his latest book just out is Greek Urban Warriors, Resistance and Terrorism, 1967 to 2014. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.